Hi, Cambria.
Hi, how's it going?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Good.
Good. All right, glad we connected.
Yeah, me too. Thanks for reaching out to me. Appreciate the opportunity.
Oh, you bet. Any questions, or should we just get right down to it?
Yeah, I'll just get right into it.
Sure. Let's start with your year of graduation and your major.
So my major was music business, and I graduated in 2015.
Was that the spring?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And within music business, I know there are different tracks, like management track, entrepreneurial track. Do you recall which track you did?
Yeah, I did management.
Cool. And what was your principal instrument?
I play the harp.
Oh, I think you're my first harpist.
Really?
So
great.
Very cool. Okay, so we'll get to your history later, but for now, tell us about your current job. What do you do?
So I am a studio manager in Atlanta, Georgia, for a sculptor. His name is Martin Daw, and the sculptor himself owns the studio and business, Cherry Lion Studios, and I manage everything for him.
Is this basically a two-person operation? You do the business, he does the art?
Yeah, so we're kind of in the middle of transitioning to that, so it is cut and dry like that. He's had this business for 30 years, and he just turned 60 this year. So he's well into his, he's, you know, a seasoned sculptor. So he's been doing both. He's been managing and doing the artwork all himself. So I've been there for just a year this last November. Mm-hmm. And it was very disorganized. It was such a mess when I first started working with him. But I had to hand it to him that he was able to stay in business for so long while managing and doing the art himself. Besides myself and the actual sculptor, Marty, we have two other employees who are on payroll. His apprentice, Pishemic, and
so what else making art, basically?
Yeah, so there are two things that we do. We make art for hospitality, which is basically hotels. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, it's nothing exciting and it's really lame concepts. So most of that stuff goes to Pishemic and the other guy. They're the ones who kind of produce that. Pishemic does a lot of critical thinking and figuring out how we're going to do these designs that we're given from our client. So he's really valuable in that way and just a great help with that. The main thing Marty does, he sculpts life-size portraits of people. So he's done several monuments around Atlanta. He's currently working on the MLK sculpture is going to be put up at the Georgia State Capitol and sometimes.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so that's kind of his, that, you know, portrait work, figurative portrait work is what Marty mainly does and what he loves to do. He also does classical relief work, but anything that's a large piece of clay that he sculpts that's eventually cast in bronze is kind of his, you know, main focus. So, fortunately this year, since I've been with him, we've had several of these large life-size bronze sculptures and a few busts and reliefs come in. So he's been very busy focusing on those things and hasn't had much time to really be that involved in hospitality, which is a good thing. That's kind of what he's been trying to figure out, on whether or not he wants to completely cut off the hospitality line of work or keep it. So
if other people are doing the work, as long as it's profitable, it seems.
Absolutely. But the problem is that we're still in the transition of managing everything. There's just so much to learn, but so far we're at a pretty good space right now where I am now finally primarily managing everything with hospitality and his bronze sculpture work. So I did a little bit of both.
Wow, cool. So, hey, just curious, mm-hmm. do you guys do the casting, or is it like he makes the sculpture in plaster or clay and then sends it off somewhere?
So that often depends a lot on how big the piece is and the budget of the client. So anything that's cast in real bronze, we create our own molds. We create them out of liquid rubber, urethane rubber, and plaster. So we'll create the molds regardless. If the client wants whatever their piece is to be cast in real bronze, we actually ship those molds out to a foundry in Utah. They're actually phenomenal. Their prices are incredibly affordable. Their patinas are beautiful. And the customer service, they're just great people to work with. And Marty's been going to them for years. But oftentimes, sometimes the clients do have a specific budget and they can't necessarily afford real bronze. So we will cast ourselves, which is called cold casting, like a composite. So it can either be bronze composite, aluminum composite, copper composite. Essentially, it's just a bunch of metal fibers mixed in with resin. And then we'll cast the molds with that in our studio.
Just curious, if you're talking a literally, roughly human-sized statue.
Yeah.
Since you're the business manager, how much does it cost to...
Not your artwork,
but like once it's done, you send the mold, they make it bronze. Like how much does that cost?
Oh, just the price to cast it in real bronze?
Yeah.
So if we were to sculpt like a 6-foot male, uh-huh. That would probably only be about maybe $18,000 to cast it.
That's expensive though.
Yeah, it's expensive, but, it's great for us because often the pricing for life-size bronze sculptures is around $100,000. So if we're only paying like around $20,000 out of $100,000 for the bronze, it's not that bad for us. Because the other expenses is him sculpting and then our two guys making the molds, and molds aren't that time-consuming and the materials aren't that expensive. So.
And do you mind sharing... like if somebody said, hey, do a sculpture of me, okay, it costs you $18,000 to turn it to bronze, but obviously you need to actually make the sculpture and make the molds. Like, how much would that be soup to nuts?
So another thing I've really worked with him on since coming onto his team is raising his prices because he was definitely undercharging a lot of his work. I have an uncle who's also actually a sculptor out in California. And
oh, nice.
I come from a family who just connoisseurs of art. So I have parents who've purchased, fine art before. And so I always just felt when I started working there that his stuff was very underpriced considering he has a lot of monuments and sculptures all around the city and his name is really well known. His name's really well known here in Atlanta. So, but now we're kind of at the point, like for instance, we just did a recent installation of it's a slightly over life size, so it's a sculpture of a man who's sitting down in a chair, but it's about 5 feet tall of him sitting down. So really, if you were to stand,
he'd be about 8 feet tall.
Yeah, exactly. So for instance, with that whole thing, that was, I think we charged $147,000 for that. Now, there's a lot that goes into that besides when Marty receives a commission for something like this, he really, the experience the client gets is really cool. The client comes in a few times, meets with Marty. Since the person that he was sculpting had been deceased for some time, they brought in lots of photos, lots of memorabilia, talked a lot about the sentimental concept behind the sculpture. He'll create what's called a maquette, which is about a foot or two mini sculpture of it. And the client gets to come in and be really specific about the facial expressions, the way he's sitting. And then after that maquette is finally at final approval, then he'll sculpt the actual life size sculpture in clay. And then the client is always in there giving critique and feedback to him. And what was really cool with this is this sculpture is going into a corporate office in downtown. and they're always having events, and they want this piece to be in the rotunda. So Marty created a hydraulic wheel granite base for them, so that way they can move this piece whenever they wanted to, and it'll just roll. So the installation was really cool, and the base itself was this custom granite base that has hydraulic wheels. You can move it around anywhere.
Wow.
So,
that's not really all that much money for what they're getting.
Exactly. And one of the things that I'm always reminding him of is that, you know, it's not just the fact that you can sculpt this in a week and it's not a big of a deal to you. You're getting where we need to be charging. Marty needs to understand that he's getting paid for his ideas. And coming up with that base was pretty amazing. And coming up with the way that the person was going to be sitting and in the sculpture, and you know, it, the artist, you know, they're getting paid for not only their abilities but for their ideas.
Well, last I checked, being at this place called Berklee College of Music, you've probably heard of it, right? That you know, gigs tend to pay really generously per hour that the person's on stage.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So it's been, and you know, I think about what I do every day at work and the education experiences I received at Berklee. I could not have gone to a better school that would prepare me for this job.
That's great. Yeah, we'll discuss that more in a little bit. So, did you say like this whole project, just curious, this project of the, you know, gentleman sitting and all that, like how long did it take for your sculptor to get this done?
So this one, you know, because it's being cast in real bronze, we have to ship it out to Utah.
Sure.
Those ones typically take a little bit longer. So with this, I'm trying to remember, we installed it November 30th, and I think they came in and ordered it around June or July. And
a few months.
Yeah, but that was relatively pretty quick for a piece that size. We typically like to keep it around 6 months. So this was closer. It was about 5 months with this. So,
by the way, you mentioned there being two other people on staff. Marty's the main sculptor. There's the one gentleman that does a lot of hotel stuff. There's you. Mm-hmm. Who's the fourth?
So the fourth is Hugo, and Hugo is the main guy who makes the molds and pours the cast. He kind of does the grunt work. And oftentimes we'll get really busy with hotel work because sometimes they'll order like 500 casts of a specific piece because they're going in hotel rooms. So, you know, oftentimes we'll contract out to some of the local art students here. So, for instance, right now we have two other kids who are working in our studio helping Hugo do the casts and polishing the materials and stuff like that. But, you know, those are independent contractors, so they're not necessarily on payroll. But that will happen pretty often.
Sure, sure. Hey, let's zoom in a little bit.
Okay.
I'd like you to discuss, just tell us about your typical day at work. Or if your days vary too much, your typical week.
So, every day is completely different. which is why I really love it. There's a brand new problem that we've never faced before that I have to solve. But, you know, typically I get into the studio, around 10 o'clock. And the first thing that I do with Marty is we sit down and prioritize the day, all the things that need to get done. And I have a lot of communication with the clients. So a lot of our clients are art consultants, which are the clients for the hotel artwork. And what will happen with hotel artwork is
sort of like interior designers and stuff.
Yeah,
like
well, technically art consultants work with the interior design company that the hotel hires.
Okay.
But when it comes to hotel artwork, our clients are art consultants, and there's only three of them that we mainly get work from. There's tons of art consultants in Atlanta, but we just really haven't had to, market a whole lot because we just get so much work from really the two or three of these main companies. So
with your staff your size, and I imagine a workspace designed for about that size.
Yeah.
You might not want to triple the amount of orders.
Yeah, there's that. Like we're really busy. And you know, it's kind of nice that we're in a financially stable spot where Marty feels confident turning down work that he just simply doesn't like. So I am very happy to finally reach that point with him. But yeah, a typical day for me is I will do a lot of clientele correspondence first thing throughout the day. A lot of quotes. I probably generate maybe around two or three quotes a day for art consultants. Sometimes most of it is unofficial quoting. It's just ballpark pricing, which is just exchanged over an email. But then, you know, it depends on the stage that they're at with the client.
To get the quotes, does that involve you talking to the other people there, or are you just
No,
very f
I typically never know who their clients are unless. It's a really, unless the client is difficult to work with,
Sorry.
and I'll end up meeting the client at some time.
I
But
didn't phrase that question right. I meant, are you talking to the other people at your studio?
oh yeah, there's a lot. I mainly talk to Pashamik, Lita Prentice, and Marty a lot. For instance, an art consultant will send me an email and say, we have this concept. It's going to be in a hotel room in 300 rooms. And, you know, can you get me pricing and lead time on this? And so before I even answer them, I go to Pashamik and I show him the concept and I ask him what he thinks. And I ask him, how long do you think this will take? What are the materials and labor that's involved? And he'll typically tell me. And then I'll generate some kind of pricing, go to Marty and double check with him. And then I'll send a pricing over to the client or an official quote, depending on where they're at with the client.
Understood.
Yeah. And then a lot of it is a lot of it is dealing with the IRS. Like, a lot of my day is dealing with overpayments and underpayments. It's all just, you know, petty stuff that you have to deal with the IRS when you own your own business. They're a little pain to deal with. But so I deal, yeah, I always get love letters from the IRS every day. It's nothing too scary. And always, you know, looking at our bill pay because we're, you know, a production studio. So we have all these different vendors and we have all these different monthly expenses from vendors we use for stuff like getting drums of resin and ordering tiny little parts from CarMax and companies like that. So we have net 30 accounts with most of these places.
I'm sorry, what's a net 30 account?
If you were to have a store like a hardware store like True Value, or not Home Depot but smaller, like an Ace Hardware store, right? If you're a business like ours who comes in there like 5 times a day, where your production guys come in there, you know, pretty frequently to get stuff, that instead of making a transaction individually every time, they just bill you at the end of every month for everything.
Gotcha. The net that you owe after 30 days.
Yeah, exactly. So we have a lot of accounts like that. So I'm always just, you know, a lot of my day is spent just kind of doing some basic accounting work, looking over accounts receivable, sending invoices to clients, reminding them to pay us because a lot of the art consultant clients have this notion that we don't get paid until they get paid from their client. And that's not true. I always have to remind them that our agreement is actually net 30 with them, regardless if they get paid or not. So that's. So I typically have to talk to somebody about that. And then, yeah, just some accounting work, something that has to do with taxes typically comes up every day. So, and then every once in a while, I'll have to go meet a client about a project we're working on. For instance, like with public artwork, that the city would be funding or would at least be contracting out for. They're legally not allowed to personally select an artist. They have to put out a public request for quote and then all these artists will apply. So I typically will look for those and apply to those I deem as worth it. And sometimes we'll get accepted and I have to go meet with the the city board and talk about the art concept and get it approved and go through all sorts of licensing for that sometimes. Sometimes we get clients where they have a piece of artwork and it's been tarnished over time, and so I'll talk to them about that. So all sorts of stuff will happen like that. So.
Gotcha. How many hours per week do you typically work?
Oh, it's a 40-hour week.
Monday to Friday?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
All right. Very nice. All right. So let's take it back now to 2015.
Okay.
So further back if you need, like I think you did mention coming from a family of art connoisseurs.
Yeah.
But I'd like to hear, like, oh, by the way, are you from Georgia?
No, I'm not from here at all.
Gotcha. So I'd like to hear, you know, your story in terms of what was your headspace there as you're finishing up Berkeley? And were you thinking you'd work in the art world? And, you know, how did we get from there to where you are now?
Cool. So while I was getting my degree, well, my first semester after declaring music business, which I declared early, I always thought owning like a music studio or managing a music studio or would always sound really appealing to me. Mm-hmm. Berkeley has a spring break trip where they take the students to Atlanta, Georgia, and that's typically organized by Karen Bell, who's the head chief of Alumni Affairs, along with Prince Charles and Carl Beatty. During 2013, I was working in the Office of Alumni Affairs for Karen Bell, and she told me about this trip that they're taking to Atlanta, and they're going to tour a bunch of different studios, meet with a bunch of different producers and music licensing offices and publishers. And I thought that sounded really great because everyone talks about, you know, New York and LA, and I've spent a lot of time in both of those places, and so I wanted to see what Atlanta had to offer. And I heard that we would be going to DARP Studios to be meeting Dallas Austin. And at the time, well, so Dallas Austin, I'm not sure if you know of him. He is a very well-known 90s R&B and hip-hop producer. So his biggest claim to fame is like TLC. And at that time, 2013, TLC was making a comeback. They were doing a 20th anniversary album and doing a VH1 movie and were performing at the MTV Awards in Japan that year. So Dallas Austin was back at DARP Studios because the girls were coming back in to do some recording for the new album they were releasing. And his, a manager, Monica Tanyan, who, you know, during TLC's prime in, you know, late 90s, managed a lot of Dallas's business. A lot. She managed DARP Studios, and with that came a lot of production management for TLC. So I knew of her, and I knew of TLC. I was a diehard TLC fan growing up, and I knew of her reputation in Atlanta and just thought she was just very smart, and I really wanted to get to know her. And she happened to be at DARP Studios when we went there to go meet Dallas. And everyone was a little starstruck by Dallas, but I was much more interested in talking to Monica Tanyan. And so I just went up to her and I said, I heard about what some of the things you'll be working on this year, and I'd just love to intern for you this summer. And she said yes. So that summer, I interned here in Atlanta for Monica Tanyan. She owns a company called Milk Money Consulting, which manages business for audio engineers and producers. At the time, she was managing an artist named Mark and Poe, and she was managing two studios, DARP Studios and Maze Studios.
A good internship for a music business manager.
Yeah, it was great. And she is just a total rock star and just very smart. I learned a lot from her and the experiences that I had while interning for her. So this is a little important as to why I later moved to Atlanta. While I was interning there, one of the audio engineers who worked there, is now my husband.
So, is that the gentleman in the photo I'm looking at?
Yes, Victor. So I met him there And, you know, I'm like 21. I, you know, didn't think it was going to happen. Anything was going to happen. So we stayed in touch and dated long distance for a few years. And, but after that, once I really got into the music business major, I really became fascinated with copyright law and specifically publishing and music licensing. So I was thinking that's what I would mainly go into rather than managing. After that internship with Monica, I realized that's just way more work than I was, way too much work for too much risk. So I really loved all the contract negotiation classes that we had and all the music licensing and publishing classes, and I was really interested in that. So my senior year, a few of the music business professors were very good to me and got me interviews with Cobalt Music in New York. And I had several of them while I was in Boston, and I had two interviews in New York with them. And my final interview was with HR, and you know, I had nothing signed yet, but
so
they had
HR, human resources, you mean?
Yeah, yep. Yeah, Cobalt. And so when I spoke to HR, you know, I told them that I was planning on moving to New York. You know, that was just my plan. I wanted to move to New York regardless.
Regardless of your man in Georgia.
Yeah, I was trying to be that strong, independent person. And you know, I was fortunate. The long distance wasn't difficult for us. We always found a way to make it work and to see each other frequently. So, which is why I felt totally secure moving to New York. So I moved to New York, and you know, it's just kind of, I guess, what happens in the music industry. Sometimes you just screw each other over. Even though the job had been promised to me unofficially without being signed contracts, I get to New York, and I had another meeting set up with HR at Cobalt, and I walk in, and they said, oh, sorry, your position has been given to someone else. Very devastated.
Like, and they figure they'll tell several people they have the job just in case it falls through with the one.
Yeah, and that's kind of how things happen in New York pretty frequently. But I was very surprised because we had talked about salary, and they did give me a small moving advance. But I thought that was strange that they gave me a small moving advance without signing anything. But I mean, it was only like $2,500. Like, that's really nothing to a company like that.
You paid for an apartment at this point.
Yeah, exactly. I was locked down in a lease, and I was planning on having a salary that would help me pay for this studio apartment on the Upper East Side. And so I had a, I
oh my
quickly
God.
Got, yeah, it was pretty disappointing. And I was really sad, too, because I would be working as a legal assistant for the legal team for Cobalt, and I had already met all four of the attorneys there, and I really liked them, and I knew they liked me.
And
so I was
in the field. You said you were really interested in all that legal stuff.
Yeah, I was really interested and excited about that, but no, it just didn't happen. So
there you are in New York, and your promised job has just popped, and it's what, like May or June, if that... 2015.
Yeah, it's like, yeah, right at the end of May. That's like almost June at this point. So I very quickly got a job with the New York Film Academy. And this was interesting. The New York Film Academy is a terrible company. The person who owned it recently just passed away. But when I was working there...
Back up just one sec.
Okay.
How did you get that job at the New York Film Academy?
I just found it on this website called higheredjobs.com because I was just looking for something, you know.
So, in other words, being in music was at this point no longer necessary.
Well, I still wanted to at least be in like entertainment law. And so I was kind of looking for something that would give me relative experience because before I applied to the New York Film Academy, I was interviewing with CSAC, and I was interviewing with a few other law firms, and I'd interviewed several times with another local music licensing company, which, by the way, had an alumni who was the one who was, you know, interviewing me. So that was really cool. So, you know, applying to the New York Film Academy sounded, you know, relevant enough because I would be, they called it a compliance officer, but really it's licensing for the music that they use in their films.
Oh, I get it. So, yes, yeah, so still music related, just.
Yeah, and still licensing related. It wasn't just music, other licensing in general. And all the other jobs that I've been interviewing for that I would also love just as much as Cobalt, you know, it became very apparent that I just didn't have enough work experience, and that was the main issue why I wasn't, you know, getting hired, of course. And so I was like, well, I need to get some kind of licensing, compliance, something in my background. Because with these companies, interviewing for them, it's pretty obvious that they weren't too specific about it has to be in the music field. They just wanted to see at least some of the tedious tasks at hand in your work experience. So
understood. So you figured this Film Academy would be logically looked at this higher ed jobs, and then you didn't have a special in there, right? You just applied, hired.
Yeah. So I was hired pretty quickly. And I, you know, since I got there, it's really obvious that there's a high turnover rate with employees over there because everything is very mismanaged, and there are definitely some ethical issues with this company.
Hey, do you mind sharing what they were paying you?
Yeah, they were paying me $45,000 a year.
That's not bad.
No, it's not bad.
Not as good in New York as in most other places.
But. Yeah, exactly. I was still poor. I was still poor because my rent was just a little over half my paycheck every month.
Oh.
And thank goodness loans hadn't been in repayment yet. So that was my other thing, is I knew like I only had 6 months to get in a better position. So I'm working at the New York Film Academy. I'm not loving it.
And you said it seemed like there were real problems with how they were
doing
business.
There were some definite ethical problems because, you know, it was just strange because the executives were just so incredibly involved in really meaningless and petty matters that just should not concern them. And there was no HR department with this company. There's no HR. So there were just a lot of things that were happening while working with this company that were just so completely unethical, and it was just very difficult to figure out how to solve these issues since there was no HR.
Can I just ask, was this like a standard for-profit company, or is this a type of non-profit?
No, they're for-profit.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So it was just very interesting, and I shared the office workspace where the three executives of the company were working, and so it was a very uncomfortable position to be in ethically because it just a lot of things happened, and there was just no way. There's like no one to go to besides the executives themselves, and they were often the problem. I just wasn't loving it there, and I was trying to figure out what my next move would be, because I needed to get out of my apartment soon. So I found a subletter very quickly.
But why did you need to get out of your apartment? Was it just...
I was in a lease for a studio apartment on the Upper East Side. And so it was pretty expensive for only, because my Cobalt job promised me $65,000.
Oh.
So,
yeah.
You know, now I'm only making $45,000.
Gotcha. You just say it was unaffordable.
It's just unaffordable. So I found someone to sublet my lease with the studio that I was in, and I was looking to move over, like, in, you know, Washington Heights, you know, upper mm-hmm. side of Manhattan, where it was much more affordable and have some roommates. You know, just a lot of weird things would happen. I'd find a place I like, meet people I'd like, and things would just fall through. Nothing was really sticking. And there was a huge issue that happened at work, and it was kind of the last straw. So I was really trying to get fired and get severance. And
technically, you need to be laid off without cause for that to happen.
Yeah. but at the same time, I was missing my long-distance boyfriend.
I get it.
So I just figured...
You'd put him on hold, you know, hold, so to speak, for this great opportunity and not just for
Exactly. Yeah. Like, if my job was a little bit more meaningful and I felt that there was opportunity and progress, I probably would have stayed. But I just really felt like there just wasn't, there just wasn't anything keeping me in New York. And I'd already found someone to take my sublet. And that person was moving in like that weekend. It was like a Monday when this all kind of occurred to me. And the person was moving in that Friday. And I was like, fine, I'm just going to quit my job and just move to Atlanta. So, so in just a few days, I quit my job. And
quick timeline on this. When was this?
So I moved to Atlanta October 1st.
Okay, so you were in New York for what, like 4 months?
Yeah, I was in New York from the beginning of May, because I moved to New York the day after graduation.
Gotcha. So
it was like the almost beginning of May until, you know, just the end of September.
Sure.
So I moved to Atlanta, and I was staying with my boyfriend until I found a job and was able to get my own place. And I was just searching on Indeed, and I saw
Can I ask about your – so mm-hmm. at this point, my impression, please correct me if I'm wrong, is, again, you're kind of like, I need a job, period. Or were you trying to be in music still or licensing, or what was your –
Yeah, so I had two thoughts. I still wanted to work in licensing or the legal field, focusing on intellectual property. And but I also knew that I did just need a job. So I was definitely looking at like temporary jobs and then getting an internship with a law firm or something. Because I worked as a law assistant for an attorney while I was at Berkeley, and like I had worked as a paralegal while I was in high school.
Oh, nice.
My dad's an attorney, so
okay.
I've been a little familiar with it. So I knew that was definitely a possibility for me, that I could find an entertainment law office somewhere in Atlanta and possibly get an internship or a part-time job or whatever, and just get some more experience. Mm-hmm. So it was kind of, you know, I was open to several different directions, and I saw on Indeed the job listing for a studio manager for the sculpture studio. And I just thought that sounded like a really good opportunity. I thought that, you know, with my internship in Atlanta, it's relevant enough.
And although your internship apparently didn't totally scare you then off doing administrative things.
Right. Well, and you know, I just kind of figured working with a sculptor is a lot easier to work with than a bunch of other hip hop and rap artists in Atlanta. so I figured that's probably going to be easier than what I was dealing with in my internship. And it has been. It's been
only one ego to manage.
Yeah, exactly. So I just found so what had happened, Marty Daw, the sculptor, his sister had just recently moved in from Massachusetts as well, and she had started her own staffing company. And she has a lengthy background in HR and administrative.
Sure.
And so he had hired his sister to find a studio manager for him, because he has a long history of having a manager who acts more like an assistant or receptionist, and he just needed to find someone new. The person who had currently working for him just really hated. She was very disorganized with the finances, and this year I found that she's lost some money. We're not sure if she kept it. We're still trying to figure that out. But he was looking for someone new, and so she just put an ad out for this position on Indeed, and I found it. And I had a phone interview with her, and then she asked me to come in and meet with her and Marty, and then I got the job. And the job, actually, they both had unrealistic expectations. The job description was pretty accurate to like what the responsibilities would be of a studio manager to what kind of artist and business Marty had. But you know, they said that the pay rate is only $16 an hour, and they're only wanting me to work 20 hours a week. And I was like, that is such a joke, but, you know, it's all right for now. I was like, well, that's okay. It's at least a part-time job for now. And I was still interviewing for other positions.
Sure.
Locally. So I was like, well, might as well take it. You know, it's only 20 hours a week for at least now.
It's a little bit of money.
Yeah, exactly. You know, so okay, I'll take it. They seemed like really great people to work with, and I just my first day, it was like only $400 in the checking account, and I was supposed to be reporting payroll the next day. I'm just like, you need me much more than just 20 hours a week. So I just worked really hard. I just organized everything because everything was just a disaster.
So did now when you went to Marty and said, "Hey, look, I can't do this in 20 hours," was he just like, "Okay, work more then?" Or
Well,
was
I
there a
didn't
push?
have to say it. My first day working for him, he was shocked. He was like, "You have done 8 times the amount of work in one day than his previous manager did in an entire week." So from the get-go, he was just very happy with me. He saw that I think like by the end of the first week me working for him, he saw that he needed me a lot more than he realized. Because I think I provided more time for him to work on other things that he'd been meaning to work on that week. Gradually it went from 20 hours to a week to, very, like the next week I just started consistently working like 30 hours a week. And I never really
And
had a,
he paid you for the 30.
oh, absolutely. Yeah. I just, he's a very laid back, easygoing, very generous type of person. So I didn't necessarily have to have a negotiation with him about what my hours would be per week. I just did the work. Every day I just come in there and I just try to solve the problems that were at hand, and I wouldn't leave unless he told me to. And then I kind of realized like, oh, like we're starting to pay me full time. I'm not sure if he's comfortable with that. And so I kind of started backing off and started like leaving a little bit early. He thought that I was leaving early because I wanted to. And I told him, I said, well, I don't want you to feel like you don't want to pay me for all these extra hours that you didn't originally expect for me to take. And he's like, well, no. He's like, you're getting so much done. Like, it's great having you here. Like, he's like, but you tell me. You tell me how much you want to work, you know? So then right after that, like within just like a month, I ended up working 40 hours a week for him just because I was just doing so much work. And there's just a lot of work to be done, especially at the point in time when I was entering that
Sure.
business.
Now, I'm not gonna. I would ask though, because I'm not gonna ask exactly what you're paid, but I'm sure you know. To do these interviews, it says you make at least 45, and
Oh,
right.
I don't make 16 an hour anymore.
Okay, so was that just part of that negotiation a month in, or was that? I'm just curious,
Yeah,
like, how
no,
did your
absolutely.
pay then raise to, what qualifies you?
Yeah, so it was around June or July, where things were getting more comfortable
So
with
you've
the
been
group.
working there for 8 or 9 months at this point.
Yeah. So it was like just like the end of spring, because the business was also in a lot of debt as well, and so we had paid off a lot of debt since I'd started working, and we had a much better cash flow, because I knew from the moment I started working 40 hours a week, I knew that I needed to get a different pay rate, because since I was putting in more hours a week, I automatically accepted more responsibility, so when things did go wrong, it's my fault. So I knew that my pay rate did need to be changed. However, I was invested in the business succeeding in general, so I didn't want to push for that at an uncomfortable moment. So I wanted to give the business the benefit of just a little bit more time before we changed that.
And then
So
it's like, okay, now that you have a good cash flow.
yeah, because I knew like from the beginning we could have made it, because like just raising my pay rate to what would be more appropriate really isn't that much more money a month for the business in general. But I knew that it would make him feel a little nervous, you know, and I knew that he wouldn't say no to me because he really does appreciate me so much. So I was just invested in the business and just wanted to, I also kind of want to prove to myself, can I get this to a much better place financially? you know, can I do that? Am I capable of helping the business grow in that way? Sure. So I waited until I saw myself do that. And then I had a conversation with him, and he had no idea what my pay rate was. Like, he one day he even like made a comment, and he goes, oh, like, event, you know, he's like, hopefully like next year you know, we could get you from making 40K to 60K. And I was like, I don't make 40K currently.
Oh, ouch.
And he's like, you don't? I said, no. He goes, well, you should. I said, I agree with you. So, you know, fortunately, I am working with an artist who is a very good person. And he values me and the work that I'm doing. And I need to be honest. I was very and I still am very underqualified for this position. He needs somebody with an MBA and 10 years of experience to come in and remodel the way everything is done here. That's what Cherry Lion Studios actually needs. But Cherry Lion Studios can't afford that. So they have me instead.
Hey, so I think there's a special pride in, quote, punching above your weight.
Yeah, well, you know, and that's why I was okay with taking the low pay rate for such a long time, because I also kind of looked at this as like an internship in a way.
Wow,
I was
great
gaining
experience.
Yeah, I was gaining incredible experience. Like everything I have learned in just this short year has just been phenomenal, and I knew that this would give me relevant work experience for any job I would want right now. Like, I'm doing credit reports, I'm working with business taxes, I also am solving intellectual property issues right now for the artists. So I'm gaining a lot of relevant work experience that I was seeking to get. And the great thing about it is, because of who Marty is, I'm doing it in a safe environment where he was coming from, I'm the person who manages everything, and, you know, here's this person who's fresh from college, and I just need to teach her everything. So I was in a safe place where it was very obvious that I was very green and that I'm learning. So it was totally appropriate for me to screw up and learn. And so I really appreciated that, and I really appreciate him seeing potential in me and having confidence that, because really he gives me way too much credit, I feel. He really thinks I'm capable of doing anything.
Well, it sounds like after a couple other people really screwed up, he's thinking about you, not you in contrast to perhaps your Berkeley classmates he hasn't met.
Exactly. Like, I was fortunate that the bar and standard had been set very low.
So anyway, so it sounds like you two just had a conversation. What's going to make you happy? And
yeah,
there you are.
Exactly.
All right.
So
great. Well, hey, let's move on to the third and final part of the interview.
Okay.
First question I have for you is, what, if any, is your current relationship with music?
So that's a good question. I still have my harp, and I still like my harp, and I still love music. I have not given up on the ambition to have a career that's more relevant to the music industry. But I still play. I'll play everyone. I'll randomly get gigs every once in a while. It's not too often on their pretty low-key. It's typically someone that I know, and I'm, you know, not really charging them that much because I'm trying to be nice, and it's just for fun. But I am definitely considering teaching again. The reason why I haven't started teaching is because the thought of starting to teach, you know, young beginner students right now and then moving in a year or two just kind of breaks my heart. Like, I feel like that puts the students at a very disadvantage, considering it would be very difficult for them to find a harp teacher.
Hold on a sec, because correct me if I'm wrong, isn't your husband still there in Atlanta working in the studio?
Oh, he's actually made a career change.
Oh, okay.
So he's no longer working as a freelance audio engineer. He is going back to school, majoring in electrical engineering.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So then after that, who knows where.
Yeah, so that's the thing is like, and neither one of us particularly love living in Georgia. So this is not the place that we want to like settle down.
Gotcha.
So I'm not exactly sure how long I'm going to be here. However, he does have two more. He's starting his program this January, so my husband does have at least 2 more years here in Georgia. So I am definitely considering
That
maybe starting.
3 years is like a good amount of experience under your belt too.
Yeah.
4 years, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So I'm thinking maybe I'll start teaching, maybe not beginner students, but students who are already here who are intermediate. So I've been looking into teacher training because I study Suzuki method with the harp, and so I'm looking into when the next teacher training courses will be for the Suzuki harp courses. But on the horizon, I definitely have law school up there. I am, and I would love to work in IP law or maybe not even go to law school, but maybe work as a paralegal for copyright, something like that. So I definitely still have an interest. I don't think that it's completely off the table. So we'll see.
Sure, very nice. Okay, next question I have for you is, I'm sure you're aware that among the, studio managers out there, only a very small fraction of them have degrees from a music college.
Right.
And so thinking about, probably most of them do have college degrees, or a lot of them, but thinking about the fact that you went to Berkeley as opposed to some other school, is there anything you feel that your Berkeley education did very well to prepare you for the job you're doing now?
Yeah, in so many ways.
Let's hear it.
Yeah. It's really cool because I'm actually using a lot of the knowledge and skills that I learned at school in my job. So for instance, one of the music business professors, Andrea Johnson, she has a very interesting work background before she started teaching. And I remember she would talk about how she worked with Island Records back in the early days and kind of started from the bottom and really made the company become something. And so in her classes with her, I took her music licensing class and her record company operations class. And in her class, she gave us some great Excel templates on one of them was specifically for studio management and for keeping track of your recording sessions. And I used that same template at work. I use it to keep track of our independent contractors that we hire, and it's helped me a lot get an overall financial picture of what our profit loss is per commission, so I have a better idea on what our quoting sphere should actually be. So there's that, and the contract negotiation aspect of my degree has helped me so much, so much. I'm constantly negotiating. I'm negotiating with Marty on how much we should price something, because he's the artist and he doesn't want to scare anyone away. And so I'm always having to negotiate with him on how really we should quote it this high. And then I go to the client and I negotiate them on meeting them somewhere in the middle. So I'm negotiating in that aspect, and I'm negotiating with independent contractors that I'm hiring. I'm negotiating with clients when they do actually hire us for a job. I'm negotiating on what the piece is actually going to entail and how realistic it is. So I think with the publishing class and contract negotiation class that I took, I gained a skill where I was able to really understand art and music as property, and learn how to negotiate on their behalf. And I learned the value of music because it's been really interesting. I guess the art world, from what I've seen, when it comes to paintings and sculptures, I they they don't have the business intermediaries down quite like the music industry does for some reason. I don't know why that is, but there seems to be a huge disparity on the value on a piece of artwork. And the music industry, there's no question the value of an album or a recorded song that's released as a single, because there's a statutory rate that protects that. We don't all love it. It's definitely outdated. But the fact that there is
right, you could sell a piece of art for whatever the buyer pays, and there's no standardization.
Exactly. Yeah, there just isn't. And I find that very interesting. There's a statutory rate for life-size bronze sculptures. And so me coming from the music industry, where I'm thinking this is so obvious on how much this piece of art is worth and how much it should be priced and what the profit should be, you know, not only is the artist himself not sure of it, but the people who are purchasing it aren't sure of it either. And the art consultants aren't necessarily sure of it either. And so it's been really interesting to kind of dive into that. And I think Berkeley has really prepared me to really assess the worth of intellectual property, specifically art, and to know how to negotiate that and make people understand what its worth is. And then, of course, all of the basic business models, you know, my finance classes, my accounting classes, I use those skills every day. So those definitely came in handy. I'm glad I took those courses seriously.
Great.
Yeah.
All right. We done on that one?
Yeah,
I think
so.
Very cool. All right, sure. Well, hey, let's turn this question around.
Okay.
Which is, you went to Berkeley knowing you gave one degree, a bachelor's in music degree.
Mm-hmm.
But is there anything where you look back at your Berkeley education and you say, you know, it would have been really helpful if Berkeley had taught this to me, and they could have, and they didn't?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the Career Development Center, mm-hmm. Really disappointed in that. I felt when I had graduated school, well, first of all, when I was applying to Cobalt, the CDC was just not help at all in terms of my resume and how to prep for an interview. The music business professors helped me with stuff like that. And I would go to the CDC, I'd get probably what was outdated information, and then I'd go to my music business professors, and they were more helpful. And then when I didn't get the job with Cobalt and I was out there swimming in the sea of trying to get a job, I really felt at a loss because I don't think I at that time understood the current standard of a resume and the current skills and techniques you use in interviews. And luckily, New York is just filled with resources, and so I went to lots of temp agencies, which do give you coaching in that. I had a really good friend who had an aunt who owned her own staffing agency, and so she gave me staffing coaching as well. And the more I would apply for jobs, the more experiences I got and critiquing my resume and getting feedback on that, the more I just realized that Berkeley just completely dropped the ball on that one. And I was really grateful for the professors that I did have that were invested. But at the same time, that's not really in their job description. So I really wish that Berkeley would have provided more resources in that way. The music business program, you know, I think since I've graduated in just this last year, it's made some pretty cool developments. They've added some new courses, but at the time when I was there, I was working with a classmate in Andrea Johnson about starting a music business publishing club, and now that has been started and it's established, and it's really exciting to see. Wish I had that my 4 years. You know, just stuff like that where, you know, you could always do more. You can always provide your students more resources. But I think that at least in terms of the music business major, it seemed that there just wasn't enough. And I don't know, you know, it's hard. It's it's hard for me to say this because I know that professors themselves made a lot of effort in this, but it's probably just an administrative battle on getting it actually executed. But it just didn't seem like there was enough instruction or resources that was relevant to having a career in general, not just in the music industry, but outside, because I just know that myself and tons of other fellow classmates were in the midst of our senior year and we're graduating in just a month and we're just looking at our professors like deer in the headlights, just asking, so what do we do? Like, none of us have jobs lined up right now. And what do we do? Like, it's terrifying. I had tons of anxiety in my last few months there. Like, I was hoping that everything with Cobalt would line up, but nothing was set in stone. And I knew that the majority of the music business students did not have this opportunity that I had. And, you know, I'm looking at Northeastern, and I'm looking at everything that they do for their students in terms of job placement. And that's, I think, the whole I can't remember what they call it over there, where they, like, take a year.
The co-op program.
The co-op, yeah. I think it would at least benefit the music business students to have a co-op like that. Like, that seems so beneficial. So if we had something a little bit more structured like that, I would have liked to see that during my time at Berkeley.
Sure. Yeah. Great answer. All right, next mm-hmm. question.
Okay.
Is you alluded to this fact that, you know, a couple bumps along the way, including a nice, you know, punch in the nose days after you graduated. But all that said, you worked your way to a pretty good job, and what? It's roughly 1 year after you finish Berkeley that you're officially now full-time, paid much more respectably, right, appreciated, doing interesting work that you were, frankly, reasonably well prepared for, as you said yourself, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, in other words, I think as you acknowledge, things have gone relatively well for you.
Absolutely.
And you got on a good path here.
Yeah.
I'm sure you're aware that a lot of your classmates have not yet found that path.
Right.
And as you even say, all those people in their last year at Berkeley staring out into the big scary world going, oh my God, what now?
Yeah.
So my question is for you, Professor Cambria. So for either or both of those groups, what advice do you have?
Oh gosh. Ugh. Well, you know, I hate this question because
sorry.
Oh no, I mean, it's a question that needs to be asked and something needs to be discussed. But you know, while I was at Berkeley, Cafe 939 would always have some cool person come in. It's like Patrice Rushen or the guy who helped Eminem get to his great career or whatever. And it always asks this question, like, what advice do you have? How'd you get where you are? And everyone's answer is so completely different. And the only thing that anyone has in common to say is just work really hard. And
all those people you heard, they're working in music and you're not.
Exactly. Yeah.
So I'm going for your perspective.
My perspective.
Don't just parrot what somebody in music said. I want to hear what you have to say.
Okay. And so you want an answer as it relates to just getting a career that you're fulfilled in general. It doesn't have to be in music.
Exactly.
Okay. Number one thing, be open-minded. Monica Tanyan, the person that I interned with, when I first moved out here, that was one of the things that she told me. She said, you know, it's just really important to be open-minded as to what you may actually want and be happy in terms of your career. She's also a person who did not come from music business background. She got her degree in economics from the University of Delaware. And here she is in the music industry. So I thought that was pretty profound and simple to make, because it's so easy, you know, dedicating 4 years to something so incredibly specific, and unless you get it down right, you're not going to get a good grade and you'll, you know, maybe fail the course. And then to graduate and to kind of just forget about all that specific coursework that you did, and just be open-minded to the fact that something else that's maybe unrelated will make you really happy and be really fun for you. So I think that's really important, is to stay open-minded after you graduate. And also, I sent an email to Ed Blomquist a little while back. He teaches publishing.
Right.
And I just wanted to keep in touch with him, and I just told him a little bit about what I was doing and told him about how I felt that the education I received from him specifically has really aided me in advancing in my current job. And he said, you know, I think that's the goal, is that we're all trying to not only teach our students about music, but how everything we're teaching can be applied to just about anything in life. And we can teach it all we want, but if the student isn't listening, and if they're not willing to apply it, then it doesn't matter. And I think just making sure that you're like paying attention to the things that are that you're learning in school, and not limit those things, because there is so many things that you can learn from music that can be applied to just about anything. You know, I apply it every day. My relationship with the artist that I manage, I learned how to handle that relationship from all my experiences at Berklee. So I think just, you know, be open-minded to things that you would be interested in.
Gotcha. Great. Yeah. Hey, let's go specifically, just to focus that in, because you're managing an art studio.
Mm-hmm.
And I would add that, right, I don't know if you looked at the big index of interviews.
I skimmed through it.
Well, you probably noticed there are over 50 of them there, right?
Yes.
In fact, mm-hmm. You're my 57th interview.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So, sorry. Anyway, my point being, I can't imagine all that many people are going to just top to bottom all 57.
Yeah.
Right? So you're going to go in there as art studio manager.
Okay.
And the people who are listening to this are the ones who are saying, hey, art studio manager, that sounds kind of cool. Wonder what that's like.
Right.
So for anyone specifically having listened to this, having thought like, wow, that sounds like a pretty fun job in, you know, in the art world. Sounds like a lot of the Berklee skills are very applicable to it. You know, mm-hmm. the pay, at least once you convince them that you don't suck, is good. Like, so for anyone who is interested in kind of getting into that field, do you have any specific advice there?
Oh, so getting into this field.
Art studio management.
Studio management. You know, unfortunately, it's small and specific, like the music industry. Like growing up, I didn't know anybody who wanted to be a sculptor. And right now we're looking for sculptors who are talented, you know, and we'd love to hire them, and we're having a hard time finding them. So I think, number one, it's going to be hard to find a talented sculptor or a talented painter or what have you. And what Marty Daw has done is pretty remarkable, what he's built. And it takes a very unique person to create what he's created, and therefore it's provided me a great opportunity. But my advice would be to someone who wants to get into this line of work would be to look into art consulting. Art consultants, you know, they don't really have too much of a specific educational background. I believe anybody could do it. I know a lot of the art consultants I work with have had some background in working in sales, because, I mean, that's essentially what they're doing. They're selling the artwork. But being an art consultant specifically, I'm under the impression that it's not going to be a too competitive job to obtain. But the reason why I would suggest that is because you're meeting all of these different artists locally or across the country. And you're going to all these different artists, asking them for work and asking them about what their production is going to be like, and what their pricing is going to be like. So all the art consultants I know that I work with know a lot about Marty and his business and what he's capable of, and they know a lot about the people and other artisans that we know. So I think art consulting would be a good way to look into that. You know, even if it is just like working as a receptionist at like an art consulting firm, that at least gets you in the door. And I know they're always looking for new art consultants because it is a high turnover type of position and industry art consulting work is. So I feel like that's probably the best way to do it. Or, you know, maybe look into like the hotel business and maybe look into interior designing for that. Or just do it old school, find an artist and, you know, handle it the way you'd handle, you know, finding a musician. So,
sure. Yeah. Great answer. All right. I just have one last question for you.
Okay.
Which is, you have the mic and you're being recorded.
Mm-hmm.
So, is there anything else you'd like to say? Anything we missed?
I don't think so. I mean, we covered a lot. I just think, I feel like it's really important that, after you graduate Berkeley and you're looking for a career that you're going to be fulfilled and happy in, is to just stay open-minded, and stay connected with your Berkeley professors. I think that's really important. And, you know, and really try to identify the specific skills and knowledge that you did gain from Berkeley that has helped you in your job search thus far, and share those experiences with your professors. I think that if I were a professor, I would want to know, because, you know, I can't imagine what it must be like being a college professor. You spend so much time with these students and you're teaching them all this stuff, and you don't really know what happens to them afterwards.
Yeah, every once in a while you hear from somebody, and it's really nice when you do.
Yeah, I think, you know, and I just think being a teacher or a professor of any kind is, it's a lot of hard work. Besides just teaching, there's a lot of administrative BS you have to put up with. And so I just feel like it's hard work in general. And the thing about professors, especially at Berkeley, is I know we have lots of professors that are annoying or difficult to work with, and we have all sorts of opinions as Berkeley students. But at the end of the day, I really do believe Berkeley professors are really trying to help their students, and they're really trying to give them as much resources as they possibly can. And I know that can be hard to see sometimes with Berkeley professors, but I think it's worth it to have patience with them. And it'll pay off. Like, for instance, some of the music business professors, I know that a lot of students didn't like a few of them that I was close with, because some of them were disorganized and just didn't really follow through with a lot of stuff. And it drove me crazy. I'm definitely one who likes to be on time for things, like to follow through with stuff. But, you know, putting up with that and giving that professor understanding of the areas that that professor was not so strong in, and the areas that all the students normally hold that against the professor, I benefit greatly from looking past that and just really trying to gain what I could from that professor. I've learned a lot from that specific instructor, and I know a lot of students just kind of roll their eyes whenever I mention that instructor, because they just have a lot of struggles. But you know, like there's a lot that professors, especially at Berkeley, go through that we're completely unaware of. But I think if you can just be patient with your professors and really try to be eager to gain the insight and knowledge that they have to offer you, you will find out that they're very invested in you finding a fulfilled career, and they will give you everything they have to help you succeed. And it's still that way after you graduate. So stay close to the Berkeley family. I think that's pretty important.
All right. Well, that's a great note to end on.
Yeah.
So great. Hey, look for a message from me in the very near future. And
great.
Thanks again for taking the time to do this.
Best of course. Luck. Thanks for reaching out, Kevin. I appreciate it.
Yeah, great. Best of luck with everything.
You too. Bye. Bye.